Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
They were reading from Canto 3, Chapter 17, Text 21. Jviksha duh sahajavam Tang viksha duh sahajivjavam Pranat kanchananupuram Pranat kanchananupuram Vajayantyasra Sraja Jushtang Vajayanta Vajayantya Sraja Jushtang Amsan Nyasta Mahagadam Amsan Nyasta Mahagadam Viksya duh sahajavam Pranat kanchana upuram Vajayantya sruta jushtam Aṃsana nyasta mahagadam Tam viksya duh sahajavam Pranat kanchana nupuram Vajayantya sruja jushtam Aṃsanyasta mahagadam. You all please chant. Tam viksya dusaha javam Pranat kanchana nupuram Vajayantya sruja jushtam Aṃsanyasta mahagadam. Tam him vikshyam having seen dusaham difficult to control javam temper Pranat, tinkling. Kanchana, gold. Nupuram, anklets. Vajayantyam, shrajam, with a Vajayanti garland. Jushtam, adorned. Aṃsam, on his shoulder. Nyastam, rested. Mahagadam, a huge mace. Translation. His temper was difficult to control. He had anklets of gold tinkling about his feet. He had anklets of gold tinkling about his feet. He was adorned with a giant garland. And he rested his huge mace on one of his shoulders. There's no purport. Next verse. Manovirivaro siktam ashrinyam akuto bhayam bhita nilaye devas tarkasya shasta eva hata. His mental and bodily strength, as well as the boon conferred upon him, made him proud. He feared death at the hands of no one, and there was no checking him. The gods, therefore, were seized with fear at his very sight, and they hid themselves, even as snakes hide themselves in fear of Garuda. Purport. The Asuras are generally strongly built, as described here, and therefore their mental condition is very sound, and their prowess is also extraordinary. Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu, having received the boon that they would not be killed by any other living entity within the universe, were almost immortal, and thus they were completely fearless. Om Agyanata Marandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Militamina Tasmai Sri Guruveya Namaha. I offer my respectful obeisances unto my spiritual masters who opened my eyes with the torch of knowledge when I was in the darkness of ignorance. So this is description here of Hiranyaksha. It's not easy to be a very big demon. Someone has to be specially given the ability by the Supreme Lord to be a big demon. Generally speaking, because of the nature of the three modes, when a person engages in sinful activity and starts to transgress the laws of the Supreme Lord, the automatic karmic reaction that we get from doing that starts to feedback on that individual. And therefore, it isn't very long before that individual is incapacitated altogether. That's why a very big demon is an extraordinary sight. Mostly, when most of us break the laws of the Supreme Lord, we get chastised by the material nature, and we don't get very far. It's not very long or very far before the police car of the three modes of nature pulls up alongside and issues us a few tickets, and pretty soon we're sitting in the jail of Tamagund. We can't really do much at that point. So that point, it's nice, actually. That way the whole material universe has a natural way of shutting down unwanted activity. That's why most of the living entities in the planet right now are in bodies where they really can't do much damage, as a tree or as a bird or as an insect. They're not able to actually create any large-scale havoc. So to see an actual potent demon is a rare sight, and it means that somehow or other, just like Shaktivesha avatars are given special mercy by the Supreme Lord to carry out some grand scheme in a beneficent way, a demon is also given some particular tejas or power, prowess, to be able to carry something in a malevolent way. So this was the nature of both Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha. As we know, they actually were pure devotees, but they could see that the Supreme Lord was eager to engage in some kind of sporting fighting contest in the material world. So because they could understand the Lord's mind, they prayed to the Supreme Lord, "Oh, my dear Lord, I see that you are eager for a contest in the material world, but we do not see anyone around who is capable of challenging you. Now, there are only weak people in the material world. Now, we're capable of challenging you, but we're not inimical to you, so we can't do this. So please arrange it somehow or other that we can become inimical to you so that we can give you your heart's desire to contest with somebody in the material world." And because they prayed in this fashion, then the Supreme Lord arranged it that they made this offense against the four Kumars, and then as a result were banished to the material world to take birth as demons. And here, as Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu, they will soon give the Lord his desire to fight in a very chivalrous bout. It's always nice to hear these stories. They give us some color, some drama, and they teach us spiritual principles. Very nice to hear these kind of things. And we actually like to hear about great challenges, great fights. Not very enlivening just to hear about somebody reading Bhagavatam in the woods, you know, for 13 years, you know. You can hear a story about somebody, so-and-so Rishi read Bhagavatam in the woods for 13 years. You know, wow, that's great. You know. Although we're appreciative of the fact this is a mode of goodness activity, very wonderful, it doesn't give us the splash of color that we're really searching for. And when we hear about the Lord engaged in a contest with a giant demon, it's very interesting. And actually, this is the principle of dramas and what they're based on in the material world anyway, some great contest between two rival opposing parties, and in many cases between the very forces of good and the very forces of evil. So very soon there'll be a big contest. Hiranyaksha was just traveling around waiting to find someone suitable for his club. And he didn't know, but everything that was given to him, all of his bodily features, all of his mental solid determination, was all a gift of the Supreme Lord. Generally, demons are unaware of why they are the way they are. They're unaware of how they got the talents and prowess, how they got the ability to actually do something much more grand scale than most living entities can do. And therefore, they're unable to appreciate who they are, how they got to where they are, or anybody else. They see themselves as the supreme summit of all humans. Ishvaraha Mahambhogi, the Bhagavad Gita explains it quite dramatically and graphically, the mentality of the demon, that I'm perfect, I'm powerful, there's none so wealthy and aristocratic as I. This is my one enemy, and I have killed him, and my other enemy I will also kill. I will give some charity, I will be happy, and so on and so forth it goes. So sometimes I detect these kind of attitudes in myself, and it's not hard to recognize that false ego jumps in there. It's our perennial enemy. Actually, it's our only real enemy, as Prahlad Maharaj will tell us later on in the unfolding of these stories about Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu. He will mention that really we only have one enemy, and that is the uncontrolled mind. And if you think about it, that's really it. That's kind of the crux, the substance of all of material life. We know that Krishna Bahirmukha Hanya Bhoga Vanchakare Nikatastamaya Tare Chapatiya Tare, that the living entity is actually there in the spiritual world, and the very instant when he decides that it isn't Krishna but rather sense gratification that he's after, then immediately chapatiya dhare, material energy, slaps him down into the material world. And like little Hiranyakashipus, little Hiranyakshas, we're sojourning around from one planet to another, from one lifetime to another, and unable to appreciate who we are, where we came from, unable to appreciate anybody else. And we're really not in a very good state of affairs. But Krishna is making it so that we can come out of this situation. He's allowing us, actually, to very easily come away from material conditioning, from the clutches of the three modes of nature, to get out of that cell, to get free from all the tickets that Maya has given us. He's making it actually very easy. All we have to do is actually remember him, which is one of the main themes of the eighth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, and one of my own main themes for the last month or so, is to think about how we have to constantly think of Krishna. If we can think of Krishna, then very easily we can get out of the clutches of material existence. Very quickly we can be released. It's just a matter of thinking of Krishna. trying to get myself to do more and more, to pray to Krishna, to recognize all my faults, and to pray to have them somehow or other gradually reduced in my heart, to take up the process very diligently of Krishna consciousness, to make progress forward, onward and onward, more and more trying to think of Krishna at every moment, and to ask him for help when I see one of my faults surfacing, when I see some difficulty that I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get across. Then that's actually the whole reason why we have difficulties. That's actually the battle. Most of the battle is fought inside. Most of the battle is actually against the uncontrolled mind, as Prahlad Maharaj says. If we can control that, then everything will be solved. As Krishna says in the 18th chapter, he's making the point to Arjuna, Matsdhani, Machchita Sarvadurgani, Mat Prasada Tarisyasi, Atatvam Cha Ahankaran, Na Shroshasi Vinankshasi, that if you think of me, you will cross over all obstacles by my grace. But if you do not think of me, instead listen to false ego, you will be lost. Na Shroshasi, if you don't hear me, Vinankshasi, you will be lost. So it's a very simple equation, and that's the main focus of it, to think about Krishna. If we think about him, we will be pulled over any other obstacle, any obstacle, internal or external. And it's the internal obstacles that are a real problem anyways. Those are the ones we really have to pray for. The external obstacles are not really such a big thing. And they don't even seem like obstacles if the internal obstacles are actually overcome. So our real obstacles are internal, to focus it in. Our real obstacle is the mind. So this is the real simple, short nutshell of Krishna consciousness, and what I'm trying to bring myself to bear in my own heart, thinking about over and over again, that I have to pray to overcome my own bad qualities, not try to become a little Hiranyaksha or a little Hiranyakashipu in my own life, but rather to appreciate other devotees and appreciate the rare gifts they've been given and the talents that they have, and to become more and more focused on Krishna and the thought of Krishna's service, the thought of Krishna's pastimes, and thinking of Krishna in many other ways, the thought of his instructions. So I don't want to take up any more time, because actually I know that Sridhar Swami has many wonderful things to say, and I will gracefully give myself the hook, get off the podium here, and turn it over to Sridhar Swami at this point. Hari Hari Bo.
I appreciated Maharaj's description very much, especially the point where he was talking about little Hiranyakashipus, and in his expressive way he put his hand over like this, pointing to me. And I thought, yes, it's
right.
Last night the first thing I noticed was that the bed was very soft, so I got Kashipu. All I need is a little more gold. And where are we here? 20?
21.
Oh, 21.
And then that was
the number. Yeah. His mental and bodily strength had made him proud. Big problem, right? Pride. False pride. Pride goeth before a fall. feared death at the hands of no one, and there was no checking him. Proverbs once said, "The trouble with you Americans is that you have no fear of Maya." We should respect the influence of Yama. In fact, not in a negative way, but Mother Kalini was relating the last time we were here an instance which took place. I don't know, over the past week I seem to have been thinking about and in touch with and relating to one of my godbrothers, dear godbrothers, whom I've spent some time with and preached together in China and other places, His Holiness Trivikram Maharaj. So, Mother Kalini, I mean, I'd spoken to him on the phone a couple of times, but anyway, she related a story where Trivikram Maharaj, I forget the details exactly of the story, but somebody was very ill, and Trivikram Maharaj made the point that don't think that you won't be like this someday. And of course that was something that he had picked up from what Srila Prabhupada had said in Vrindavan when he was lying on his bed there and very emaciated, and of course all his disciples were there and feeling great pain and for Prabhupada unconsciously they were thinking that this won't happen to me. In fact, we know that Yama himself extracted from Yudhisthira ahani ahani gacchantiha yamalayam. The most wonderful thing is that at every moment people are dying, but we think that it won't happen to me. That's the most wonderful thing. So death, which is preceded often by disease, is going to happen to all of us. And it's when we see it taking place, of course, one reaction is to be like the rabbit and put our big ears over our eyes and pretend the fox isn't there, or like the ostrich and stick our head in the ground. But a better reaction is to just acknowledge that this is Mrityu Loka, Martya Loka. It's a place of death. Everything's already dead. The only thing that is alive is the soul. And that soul will not and cannot stay in the body very long. So we say it here, and Prabhupada quoted it. There are only two things that are sure in life, which are what? Death and taxes, right?
Mark Twain.
Mark Twain said that, but Prabhupada also quoted him. Death and taxes, or as sure as death. He used to quote that also. So, how do we face that? Well, we learn a lesson. Everything is an opportunity for us to expand our realizations, and death is just one side of life. There are so many lessons, and death is nothing to lament about. It just happens. And we can learn from it, especially, we probably can learn more from disease because death is the end and you're gone. But preceding and leading up to death, we can learn a lot. But if we're so proud, it's a big problem, if we're so proud, pride can be under the heading of ahankar, or false ego, or amanitvam, adambitvam. Krishna lists the characteristics of demoniac person and or the obstacles to devotional service, and this false pride is one of the bigger ones. It seems here that it seems to come up all over the world, this topic of mind, and I think it's probably the most often asked question in gatherings, satsangs, tete-a-tetes. how do I control my mind? Arjuna, 5,000 years ago, he was emperor of the whole world. He was not a small timer. One would think he had relative good control of all his senses. He protested to Krishna. What to speak of us? He, and 5,000 years ago when the conditions were much better, Chanchala, he, Mana, Krishna, Pramati, Balava, Dridam, my mind is chanchala, it's very restless. It's pramati, very obstinate. Pramati balavat, very strong. It seems like it would be easier for me to control the wind than to control my mind. Vayorivasudushkaram. I could control vayu, but I can't control my mind. And of course, Arjuna was capable of defeating demigods and probably could control vayu, but he could not. He protested to Krishna, perhaps on our behalf, that I cannot control my mind. And Krishna acknowledged it. He said, Manor durnigraham chalam. Yes, I agree with you, Mahabahu, O great armed one, great personality, you're right. But abhyasena tu kaunteya vairagena chagriyate, that by constant endeavor, by being vyavasayatma, controlled mind, but the fact is that by association with devotees, by constantly hearing, by this type of sadhana, we can get a desire to control the mind, a strong desire. By recognizing that our uncontrolled mind has caused us unlimited distress in the past, and if we want to get relief, then we must become the master of our mind, not the servant. Goswami instead of Godasa, or make the mind our bandhu, our friend, rather than Ripu, our enemy. So this is a nice verse that I just happened to open to in the Upadeshamrita. The essence of all advice is that one should utilize one's full time, 24 hours a day. So full time is defined here as 24 hours a day, not 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day or not even 18 hours a day, but 24 hours. That means in sleep also. In nicely chanting and remembering the Lord's divine name. Now, I've had experience, and I'm sure some of you have also, of getting back late to the temple, certainly in the early days when the Brahmacharya ashram was maybe a room as big as this, or half as big as this, but everybody slept in the same room. On the floor, and getting back, and you know, the Brahmacharya ashram was filled up, and you know, trying to navigate your way through all the sleeping bags to get to your little 6-foot space. And I have heard people, and not just once, but maybe 3 times, I heard it. Devotees chanting in their sleep. Anybody ever heard that before? Huh? Maharaj has heard it. Yeah. Tarak has heard it. So, it is possible, 24 hours a day. Oh, someone was selling a book in his sleep.
He found money in his sleeping bag.
Get out of here. Is that money that he kept?
Fill it out of his pocket. Yeah. One can only wonder.
In nicely chanting and remembering the Lord's divine name, transcendental form, qualities, and eternal pastimes, thereby gradually engaging one's tongue and mind. In this way, one should reside in Braja, Goloka Vrindavan Dham, and serve Krishna under the guidance of devotees. One should follow in the footsteps of the Lord's beloved devotees who are deeply attached to his devotional service. In the purport, Prabhupada mentions, since the mind may be one's enemy or one's friend, one has to train the mind to become his friend. The Krishna consciousness movement is especially meant for training the mind to be always engaged in Krishna's business. So, an idle mind is what? Devil's workshop. Where's that from? Is that from the Bible? I think so. Some reference to that. But anyway, everybody knows that it's traditional. But if you don't engage the mind somehow or other by active devotional service, or if you have got a taste, then in reading and in constant chanting, and that means more than 16 rounds. 16 is just a minimum. You know, the nice story that Shrutakirti tells. Everybody knows who Shrutakirti is? Prabhupada's servant of yesteryear. So they were chanting japa together, and Prabhupada would chant, at least externally, he would chant 16 rounds. So he finished his last bead, then he took his hands out of the bead bag and threw the bead bag down and said, now I have chanted my 16 rounds, now I can do any damn thing. In other words, you know, we're just chanting to get our rounds out of the way so that we can do what we really wanted to. Well, I say we because I mean me, but chanting, you can chant as much as you can, especially in a nice place here in the winter time. There's not a lot happening. You can chant more, hopefully. But the mind must be engaged somehow or other. Otherwise, invariably, and this is illustrated here or articulated here, the mind contains hundreds and thousands of impressions, not only of this life, but also of many, many lives of the past. These impressions sometimes come into contact with one another and produce contradictory pictures. In this way, the mind's function can become dangerous for a conditioned soul. So, this is the point, you know, you get this video replay of your past activities. The mind, you know, flicks the switch and you get out of control and can lead you in the wrong direction. You thinking, feeling, and then willing. All sinful activity begins in the mind. You're not responsible for that mind, but invariably the progression leads you to acting. So the key is that we have to control that obstinate, turbulent mind. And, you know, Bhaktisiddhanta's formula was that, you know, when I get up in the morning, I give a good kick with my foot to the mind, and in the evening I take a stick and I beat my mind. So, you know, we're not talking about something physical where you know, like there's a sect of Islam where they walk through the streets and flagellate themselves. But metaphorically, you should think that your mind, unless you give it no quarter, as they say in sword fighting and whatnot. You give it no room to get, you just chastise your mind. If you have a pugnacious nature, if you like to fight, then fight against your mind. Don't fight against Vaishnavas. Don't fight against the world. Don't think of yourself as a victim. Don't get embroiled in, you know, things that will just drag you down. But fight. Channel all your energy. Be tough on yourself and gentle with others. So beat that mind into submission and make him your servant and your friend. You know, generally with a friend, you know, you approach him and give him gifts and, you know, make concessions, and but that's not the way to make the mind a friend. The mind can absorb all the sense gratification you can give. You have to withdraw. Yada sangharate chayam kurmonga niva sarvasaya, like the tortoise draws its limbs within the shell. It's somewhat like that. Indriyan indriyate vyastasya pragya pratishtita. The pragya pratishta, who can control the mind, he's someone who has withdrawn his senses, who has restricted his mind, who's starved the mind into submission. So, or at least engaged the mind in a positive way. In this way, the mind's function can become dangerous for a conditioned soul. The students of psychology are aware of the mind's various psychological changes. In the Bhagavad Gita, it's stated, yam yam vapi smaran bhavam tyajati ante kalevaram tam tam eva iti konte asadata bhava bhavitaha. Whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body, that state he will attain without fail. At the time of death, the mind and intelligence of a living entity create a subtle form of a certain type of body for the next life. If the mind suddenly thinks of something not very congenial, one has to take a corresponding birth in the next life. On the other hand, if one can think of Krishna at the time of death, he can be transferred to the spiritual world, Goloka Vrindavan. So, This is... I once heard a lecture by the Dalai Lama, the Dalai Lama, and he loves to talk about mind. And nice gentleman, he came to our Bhaktivedanta Institute-sponsored synthesis of science and religion conference on Lord Chaitanya's 500th anniversary in Bombay, and he spoke. He was keynote speaker, and we've seen him on other occasions. But although they do talk about mind a lot, he loves to speak on mind, but they really don't have any sadhana to control the mind. In China, you'll see, in Taiwan, even in mainland China, you'll see by the roadside Buddhists who will have a log or something, a stick, and they'll be, you know, hitting the log with the stick. What they're doing is they're beating all the thoughts out of their mind. I don't know how that works, but not very well, I don't think. You have to engage the mind in a positive way, and even if the whole description of Krishna Leela and pastimes are allegory, which we know they're not, but even let's say for conversation's sake that they're allegory, it's certainly a much more attractive way to engage the mind than to, you know, sit there beating a stick, you know, against a log, you know. So we have the opportunity, if anybody has the opportunity to control the mind, we do. We just have to develop the commitment, make a commitment, develop the determination, and of course that is certainly most easily done in this association of others who are also endeavoring. A lot more openness is necessary, a lot more guhyamakyati prichiti, heart surgery. We need heart surgery. Call Shamika here. So do some heart surgery. Any of you would like to make any comments? Now would be a good time. Ask any questions.
Right. I know our main function is trying to always think of Krishna, never forget Krishna. And chanting seems to be automatically thinking of Krishna. But engaging in service, sometimes we get caught up in a project and they get a sort of attached to the service, and sometimes you may have a tendency not to be thinking of Krishna. What is a good way of making that service as much Krishna conscious as chanting?
I guess I'm de facto supposed to answer this question. Okay. You're able to proceed?
Yeah, I can proceed.
Okay. Okay. Actually, that's a very good question. I've been meditating a lot on it myself recently. In the eighth chapter, Krishna says, just think on me and perform your prescribed duty of fighting. In this way, with your activity engaged in me and thinking about me at the same time, you will come to me. So we have to do both things. We have to think about Krishna, and we have to physically do things. So oftentimes I'm thinking, okay, here's Mangal Arati. I'm singing some words. What do they mean? Why am I singing them? Why do we do this? If I'm doing service, I'm thinking, well, what's the nature of the service? What are the essential things I'm trying to accomplish? How can I accomplish them better? How can I accomplish them more nicely? How can I accomplish them in a way to do them harmoniously with other devotees? And in this way, we can either think of Krishna while we perform our prescribed duty of fighting against the material energy, or we cannot think about Krishna. If we don't, then we're performing our prescribed duty of fighting, but actually we're getting into a ritualistic mentality. We're bumping through items and situations in the material world, but what's going on upstairs is not connected. The clutch isn't in, you know, it's a neutral up there. And because there's something else going on upstairs, there's a possibility of the mind getting off on another track. So as we know, from whatever and wherever the mind wanders due to its flickering and unsteady nature, one will certainly withdraw it and fix it upon the self. So like a muscle, just like we flex our muscles when we're physically working, in the beginning we may not have such a capacity to work so hard and long and to lift so much. But after some time from working hard and long, our muscles develop and they get toned up and we can do more work and we don't get sore and we can lift more. So similarly, we have to tone up the mental muscle of bringing it back from wherever it goes, back on what we're doing. And we have to remember that, you know, it isn't a ritual process. And if we get into ritual, we're really missing Krishna consciousness. And eventually our mind will drag us into something that's unfortunate. So we have to remind ourselves, why am I here at Mangal Arati? What are the words to this Sanskrit song mean? Why am I singing them? How is it relevant to my life? What am I going through? Why do I listen to class? What did they say today? How does it relate to what I'm reading? What is my service? Why have I been given that service? What are the essential things I'm trying to accomplish? How can I accomplish them better? In this way, the mind is focused in on what the body is doing. And with the two together, just fight, perform your prescribed duty of fighting, and at the same time, think of me, with mind engaged in me, and with your activities dedicated unto me, surely you will come to me without a doubt.
Thank you, Maharajas, for a nice class. I'd like to ask a question. You mentioned, Chandrasekhar Maharaj, the appreciating the rare gifts devotees give, and also like the, you know, just the association of devotees. I'd like to say that sometimes the rare gifts isn't always something we like to hear or like to get, because sometimes the rare gift comes in the form of, you know, smashing the false ego. You know, because that's, you know, and that's the spiritual friendship that one has to understand. Because I know sometimes I get caught up in the material aspect of friendship, you know, but when it comes to the ego, it's just like, not so fast, you know. But at the same time, we always pray, oh Lord, you know, I want to be humble. But then when the opportunity comes, it's like we run from it.
That's really our, I mean, is our false ego, and it'll crop up again and again until we die in various forms and shapes and various ways and permutations. And we somehow have to, time and time again, see that it's crept in and weeded out again, and appreciate sometimes when we get chastisement or when people notice our faults and actually think, yeah, this is a fault. I really do have it. I really do have to do something about it. This is another way to engage the mind in recognizing the things we have that are not, that are there that shouldn't be, and make a real effort to get rid of them. Otherwise, we just become complacent. We think, well, I'm not so hot, but that's okay. And, you know, I just let it mush along, you know, until somehow or another, as one devotee used to say, you know, wake me up when we're back home, back to Godhead. It's not quite so passive, you know. We have to actually work at becoming more purified. Care to say something?
I'm sorry. I got it. Lolium, you have to be so greedy that you can taste it in your mouth. You have to want Krishna consciousness so badly. One way to look at things is to look at your past life, and until you have a very bright future outlook, look at your past, and at least for most of us, it's not hard to appreciate that we have been suffering under the grips of Durga Devi. She has a trishul, and each one of the prongs of her trident are adidaivik, adibhautik, and adhyatmik klesha, and she, you know, pricking us and skewering us. So we have suffered. Some people, relatively speaking, think they haven't suffered. And, you know, well, maybe they can appreciate other suffering and understand, you know, this good Bengali example of, you see it in the villages in India, and you can even see it in the city sometimes on the outskirts, where the villagers who have come to the city to make money are living, and they live in little huts, and, you know, the wife is very early in the morning out there cooking the daily meal, and they cook with gober, which is cow dung, dried out cow. They make, you know, the cow passes her dung, and then they mix it with straw, and they make pancakes, and, you know, put it on the wall, and as the sun comes up, it dries out. So they're cooking, the fire is there, and you know, the wife is putting the gober in the fire, and it's burning, the dried out gober. But the wet gober is still on the wall. So the proverb goes, gutte pore gober hase. The wet gober is thinking, look at my friend, he's burning, and I'm having nice sun bath here, I'm enjoying, you know, nice warm rays of the sun. But he doesn't realize that very soon he will dry out and be pulled down from the wall and thrown into the fire. So, you know, don't think this won't happen to you. It will. No matter what background we're coming from, but life works like that. A series of deep valleys and high plateaus, and we're just moving from souk to duk, and back to souk, and down to duk. And so by recognizing that, sometimes you can get a little, you know, fear. Fear is not a bad thing. If nothing is by nature bad. What is that verse? E bala e mande sab brahm. Gyan sarva mano dharm. E bala e mande sab brahm. someone who thinks that there is good and bad is an illusion, Brahm. It's just a big, there's no good or bad. What takes you closer to Krishna is good, and what brings you away from Krishna is bad. So, somehow or other, you have to attain that determination, that intense desire, and you could remain here in a paradigm paralysis state for many, many lifetimes. And I it's not worth it. You have to make the effort to know Krishna. Krishna will reciprocate, no doubt, but there's nothing like sleeping until we get back to Godhead. Either you're going forward or you're going backward. You can't tread water. Either you're making incremental progress or you're making incremental regress. So the choice is yours. As far as I'm concerned, the material world is a stinking, rotten, dirty place. There's nothing nice here. And I don't want to have to come back again. And, I'll try my best to do anything that will help me get out. And I think everybody should, have that determination.